Blog Talk Radio.
It's Monday night, it's 10 o'clock, and it's the latest episode of Graphic Policy Radio. I'm your host, Brett, and waiting for my co-host to want to call in. But I figured while I do that, I will talk about some of the latest news to come out and some good stuff to come when it comes to our rights and free speech. So a great organization that y'all should be supporting, the Comic Book Legal Defense Fund, doesn't just stand up for us comic book folks, also the video game players out there. They signed a letter, they announced today on their blog, they signed a letter protesting a video game ban in a New Jersey library. So last Friday, National Coalition Against Censorship sent a letter to Paterson Free Public Library, Paterson, New Jersey, to protest their new policy that bans playing certain video games. Particularly, this library decided to single out first-person shooters on library computers. So the CBLDF is one of the organizations that signed this letter, and what the letter basically says is that video games are protected free speech and therefore cannot be censored in libraries. I want to remind folks that last summer, there was actually a Supreme Court case. It was Schwarzenegger versus EMA, the Electronic Merchants Association. And since Schwarzenegger lost, it then turned into Brown versus EMA. And that piece of decision by the Supreme Court said that video games is protected free speech and that the government could not censor video games in any way, that they're protected just like movies and books and television, and that the government shouldn't censor. And that court case actually came around because California decided to try to limit the sales of video games to those under the age of 18. So even the actual majority decision was written by Supreme Court Justice Alito, who's rather conservative, who basically compared video games to grim fairy tales. So it might not be pretty. It might be pretty grim, pretty gross, pretty violent, but they're free speech. So with this letter that was sent to this library, you know, takes them to task for the same unsupported views that says video games can lead to violence, following erroneous research that's out there linking the two. In this letter, they said, to quote, "The library has not offered any sound justification for removing access to specific games. Said according to published reports, librarians are taking this action to, quote-unquote, prevent our kids from learning these behaviors. This assumes that viewers will simply imitate behaviors represented in fictional settings without any independent mental intermediation, proposition which is palpably false. The library implicitly rejects by offering access to all sorts of internet sites and maintaining a varied collection of book, magazines, videos, and other materials." So basically, you know, there is material that is equivalent to these video games that are on the library shelves. And to ban one and not the rest is very hypocritical. I suggest folks, if you're a comic book fan, to go and to support the Comic Book Legal Defense Fund. And if you really care about video games and your rights and speech, I suggest going with the Entertainment Consumers Association. They're at the ECA.com. It's a great organization that I do some work with. They're also fighting for this same thing. So just want to start off. Good news. Folks are fighting for our rights and standing up for free speech. And joining with me is Alana. How you doing?
Hello. Hello. Sorry for the hold up over there.
It's all good. I think I covered pretty well.
Yeah, clearly. That sounded really interesting.
Yeah, well, so yeah, I don't know if you know, it's an organization that I run their online advocacy and very involved with. It's the Entertainment Consumers Association, which is a nonprofit, not to hawk you know, someone I work with or anything like that. But it's a nonprofit that fights for behalf of video game consumers. So obviously, with all the hubbub up about games and violence, things have been rather busy lately. So it's been fun.
Gotcha.
Yeah, and then I was just saying the Comic Book Legal Defense Fund steps up. They do more than just comics. They join with this National Coalition Against Censorship to protest a library in Patterson who decided to censor some games in their library, which I find the whole idea of a library censoring anything, like, repugnant.
Absolutely.
So,
the exact opposite of the point.
Yeah, I mean, kind of blows my mind that there's this idea that a library should be free and open to the public and for the public good and give access to materials that you might not necessarily be able to find elsewhere. And here they are censoring and denying it. So it's a little disheartening, very disheartening.
And yeah, highly predictable.
Yes, 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 yes. So we got a bunch of stuff to talk about this week. So I start with maybe the WTF.
Yeah.
You sound so excited.
Ooh.
So, WTF, I believe that kind of sums up our thoughts on this. DC Comics has decided to, hopefully get some people looking on their comics with a month that they call WTF certified. And what that is these comics will have, like, gatefold covers, or gatefold covers, and part of the cover will fold back to reveal a shocking moment that will have something to do, supposedly, with what's on the inside of the comic. And they're teasing that there's going to be all these crazy things going on. Someone's going to die. Someone's going to be a traitor. New teams will form. Some team's going to disappear. I mean, it's all a bunch of, like, crazy moments. So, first, your initial thoughts on this.
My initial thoughts were, what the freak do you think you're doing? Who is this appealing to? When I got a little bit more information about what the specific storylines were, you know, I do think some of them sort of sound creative and interesting. But using this as a marketing approach, I don't really see what it does. It's not growing their audience. I don't know. Maybe it does get a few people to pick up, who are already comics readers, to pick up one more book than they normally are getting, I guess. But honestly, you know what would do that too? Would be like a better explanation of what's in which book anyway. I'm skeptical about it, but it sounds like some of the individual issues might be good individual issues. I think calling it WTF is a really bad idea because of what WTF actually stands for. Like, if it was for Vertigo, okay, but, like, are you just going to assume that all comics are for adults then all the time, 100% now? I mean, I guess, I don't know. I just seem weird to make that be a line across the entire line saying, but the whole thing is really, really ham-handed. Like, the whole kind of concept of doing it just seems kind of pathetic and sad.
And that's, you know, so the first thing that came to my mind, and it was one where I kind of wondered if I was just being too conservative in a way, but I'm glad you said it, is like the branding of WTF isn't kid-friendly. Like, imagine a father or mother taking their kid into a store and seeing this, and there is a logo out there that says WTF certified. I don't know if that's going to be stamped on the covers. But assuming it is like, how is a parent supposed to explain to a kid when the kid says, what does that mean?
Any kid old enough to read a comic knows what that means. But it just makes the whole thing seem like it's not something which they should have.
Yes.
You know? And in reality, there certainly are titles that you probably wouldn't have a kid read. But it's individual. It's not like, oh, all DC books, you know, would be inappropriate. So it just seems misguided to me.
Yeah, and the other is like, and I've seen this kind of brought up a few times, and there's a couple of articles that have touched on it, and I tend to agree on it, is it seems very, like, just, we're going to throw out this shocking thing, as opposed to relying on good art, good storytelling to get people in. Uh-huh. Like Marvel uh-huh. killing off, you know, Marvel joked that they would kill off a character a quarter if it got them the sale that they've seen with things like Spider-Man or Fantastic Four. It kind
with
of
the Fantastic Four scheme worked
with the Human Torch.
Yeah,
it, I mean, it got a lot of eyes on the thing. There was tons of coverage.
Coverage, yes, but did it sell? I didn't know if their scheme worked. I believe the Spider-Man one did because it seemed like that was part of an actual story. Like there was an actual like reason and direction for that. But I did not think that people had picked up the Fantastic Four book to see Johnny Storm be dead for like three months or whatever.
Yeah. I would say the initial comic sold really well. No, like that particular comic, I think it was Fantastic Four 600 maybe, I don't, whatever it is. That particular one did really well. After that, and sales probably decreased like they normally do.
Yeah, because that's just no way to sustain your industry, you know? It's just silliness.
Yeah, I mean, it kind of reminds me of the worst of the 90s when everything was a chromium cover and a variant in it. I just feel like no one's learning from the past. Like,
nope. Well, because the same people are in charge, right? Everybody who made the 90s fail is in charge of comics now, so.
Yeah, there was, I forgot who, maybe it was the AV Club I sent it, or so, it was someone that pointed out was like, the people that really led the charge in Marvel in the 90s are now some of the ones that are calling the shots in DC. What a shock that DC is very much Marvel 90s.
Gosh, that's so sad.
But yeah, I mean, like, to me, the big question would be is how do you go about marketing comics and getting people interested that might not be not relying on these type of moments and variant covers?
Gee, Brett, I bet it would be really hard to come up with a list of ideas of things you could do instead of this. Let's think about some of those suggestions. I think you might have had some ideas in the past that would be worth repeating at this juncture.
I feel like we've talked about this before a few times.
But it's been a number of months, though, at least.
Yes, yes.
Maybe more.
And we have a lot more people listening now, so.
Exactly. So let's talk about this. I mean, one of your ideas, of course, was that you should sell comics for the movies that the movies are based on in the theater that is showing the movie.
That was
one idea. That was pretty awesome.
It blows my mind. So we'll stick with that one. So you've had, well, let's start with that. So actually, it's good that we are bringing this up. And so Entertainment Weekly, this past issue, posted up like the top movies of the year money-wise. Between Avengers, between just the four comic movies that came out. So Avengers, Batman, or Dark Knight Rises, Amazing Spider-Man, and Men in Black 3, which was a comic book movie, because Men in Black was originally a comic. Those four movies accounted for, I think, over $3 billion in sales, in ticket sales. So if you say $3 billion, we'll divide it by 10 or 15 bucks. You know, how many people saw each of those movies then?
Yeah, astronomical. And it would have been great to be able to tell them that there's comics dealing with the same characters and storylines that you've just witnessed, and you could purchase them yourself for the low, low price of $2.99 or whatever. I mean, it's just ridiculous to not do that. I don't know if, like, why they don't. I don't know why they don't do that.
Well, I mentioned that you give a comic for the ticket. You know, you pick up your ticket, you pick up these comics, maybe
opening free, like, promotions. Yeah.
Yeah, even like opening weekend, you do a simple thing. Maybe you get a ticket, you get a comic, and I can't think, someone did something like that, whereas you got a ticket and then you got something for buying the ticket, and I wish I remember what the hell it was, and I'm totally blanking on it, but it did really, really well. So you do something simple like that. Maybe DC does a thing with advertising where you can get, for stores, if you include like DC characters, at least you used to be able to get some of the money back for advertising. Like, how about you subsidize stores and rent seats and movie theaters for?
Oh, sorry, you were just breaking up. Can you repeat that?
Oh, so DC used to do it in stores when they were advertising. they would give them, you know, subsidize some of the ads if you use DC characters. So, am I sound better or no?
Yes, now you're better.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I've got a backup phone just in case. So they would give you some subsidy of the advertisement. So, like, maybe they subsidize renting out a small space in the theater, or shit, they just go and put product in the theater and split the money like concessions.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And some stores are smart about it. I mean, there were also some stores that would deals with local theaters and do like mini comic cons and events around the sort of stuff.
I didn't see that happening in New York, really. And there's a big gas movie theater right across the street from Forbidden Planet Comics, which is like the really big local comic store.
Yeah, I mean, it kind of blows my mind. Like, there was the Comic Con Episode 4 came out. It was a DVD, and they did a thing, and I forgot the service they used, but basically you would help promote the movie in your area. You'd get a theater to show it in, and then you'd get the people in the seat. So, like, a really grassroots thing. I know a lot of movies, especially low-budget ones, are moving towards this model to get them in theaters. You know, shit, you do that, and you get local people to help, you know, promote the movies, and you make it mini comic conventions in a way. You have costume contests, you have prizes. Like, this all seems really simple to do. I mean, how many theaters are out there compared to comic stores? Or maybe there's four times, you know, 4,000 or 5,000 theaters.
Mm-hmm.
If that, I mean, I see movies that are the big ones are like 2,400 screens. So maybe it's not even that many.
Yeah. I mean, that's just a start. And then, you know, I mean, this is going to actually fit in with the Facebook statistics that you found. But just even advertising to people who say that they like these superhero movies, like referring them, like looking at their demographic data and like referring them to comics that they might like. Like if it's a kid, sending them to the young, you know, to like the young titles. You know, if it's a woman, maybe send them to the Black Widow miniseries when the new Avengers movie came out, you know. Like there's, or if you list her as your favorite character, like there's so much targeting that could be done in contextual ads from Facebook. I take for granted that people know how these things work because of my like work doing advocacy work and activism. I'm really aware of it. But if folks don't know, I mean, people can buy Facebook ads targeted to you based on the interests that you list on your Facebook profile, based on your demographic data, and it's cheap as heck. And that would be a great way to expose people who are sort of at the peripheries of superhero culture to, you know, reading comics themselves, right?
Yeah, I mean, I did the latest report on Saturday, and it came out to be about 1.8 million people self-identified comic fans. And we're not even talking people who say they like Superman or Batman or Wonder Woman or Spider-Man. These are people who say they like Marvel Comics or DC Comics or Vertigo. So to say you like those things, you've got to be in the know of comics somehow. You know, that's 1.8 million people that are being reached out to. I mean, I have yet to see an ad targeted to me that says, here's a free code for a digital comic.
Yep.
And
that's so easy.
Oh, very simple. And it would be cost.
Why
isn't
Dark Horse promoting Buffy comics to Buffy fans on Facebook, right? Like,
I am not a Buffy fan, so they might be doing that.
Well, you know, you're right. I'm not either, but I think we'd know if they were, since we talk about this a lot.
Well, so Dark Horse did do something smart. I mean, they've got they put these kind of digital packet samplers together that are usually first issues. So they have one that is Buffy-centric. That was Buffy, Willow, Spike, like, I don't know the shows, but those type of stuff all wrapped in together. And I got the press release. I posted up on our site. You know, I didn't know how much further they reached out to on that, but, you know, that was a good first step. The next step would have been to advertise to Buffy people.
Yep, that's better than we're hearing from the other folks, that's for sure. So there really are, you know, lots of ways they could be growing readership. And there's just 90s-ing it up. I don't understand what kind of like emotional trauma they experienced in the 90s that have forced them to feel the need to replay it endlessly. But there were a lot of bad things happened then, and you know, there's a reason why we were cleaning out my fiance's garage, and there was like 50,000 pounds, metric pounds, of comic books there from a store that closed in 1993 that was all closeouts, millions of issues of The Death of Superman in boxes that had been bought, like, as you know, when they ran out of business, his dad was like, sure, I'll take your stock off your hands for, you know, $40. You know, bought all the comic book company's back stock for like $40 or whatever. And, you know, there's a reason why there were crates and crates of The Death of Superman and plastic bags in that garage.
Yeah, I mean, that always amazed me because I remember Death of Superman. People were, I mean, that was a huge cultural thing. It was on CNN. It was the big news. And there's lines of people, and it was rationed. And now you can buy that book for in dollar bill bins.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm just like, the only thing I can think of is that they look back and see those numbers during the 90s and see, you know, 700,000 copies sold, a million copies sold, and said, hey, you know, that sold books, not thinking of like the crash that occurred a few years later.
Yeah. It's really remarkable and sad.
Yeah, I would love to get a higher up on the show to discuss these things and pick their brains.
And why they just don't do it. I tried to raise the question of the Facebook advertisements with someone from Marvel at Comic-Con, and I think it was the wrong person, and the person got really defensive. I probably broached it in the wrong way, but it just... It was ridiculous. If there are broke nonprofits who are able to do good email and activist recruitment through cheap Facebook ads. I'm sure Marvel has money to do this.
Well, we could start on email. I am on every press list you can imagine, and the press stuff's decent. But try to go find an email list sign up for most of the publishers. You can't, they're done. Marvel has some, and I don't even know if you can sign up for it or you have to download something and sign up for an account to get it. Like, just give an email address and sign up. DC might have one, maybe. I mean, most of these folks aren't even running email programs.
Yeah. I mean, it's really scary. If, like, absolutely broke grassroots nonprofits are doing more innovative online campaigning than you are and you're a multinational company. Or even a part of one of them. So those are things they could be doing instead of what they're doing now.
Not doing it.
Yeah.
Sigh.
So, moving on to happier times. What were the most exciting new discoveries from your look at Facebook statistics while we're talking about it?
Let me bring up that post. The thing that's interesting is the last 2 months, there's been this steady slide and loss of fans. And I don't know why, but it's primarily under the age of 21 that are I don't even know what to call it, non-friending, defanning these properties. But what's even weirder is the older are gaining.
Uh-huh.
So under 21 is losing, while over 21 is actually gaining here in like a little bit. We're not talking a lot. We're talking maybe 800 people, 200 people. But it seems like the older you get, the more it's kind of holding steady, not gaining completely. And then women was the biggest loss compared to men. 10,000 fans to 7,000. And then the other was a good chunk of that loss of about 17,000 people were Spanish speakers, which was about 3,000.
Yeah.
It's all very strange. So the only thing thought I can have that I have is that it's the end of the year. We're far out from movies, so maybe people are kind of just cleaning things up, and you know, this isn't on their mind because there's no movies to really catch them.
Well, what I don't understand is when is the last time that you've updated your interests on Facebook? I don't know when I've last updated my interest on Facebook. Maybe this is something that, like, really young people do. So the whole concept to me of it shrinking, I just don't even see how that happens.
I do it once in a while, but very rarely. Like if it's once a year and I'm bored sort of thing, I might do it. But that's a good point. Is like I generally don't do anything unless this is just an activity of younger people that we don't do, which would explain why the older remain kind of steady or gain, and the young kind of fluctuate more.
Yeah, if you are a young, and by young, I mean like someone in their teens, basically, person who is listening to this show, definitely drop us a note and let us know about your strange, alien, and teenage ways and whether or not you've been known to frequently change your interests on Facebook. Yeah.
It's been, for both of them, has basically been the same thing, is this younger demographic are the ones that are being shed while the older is staying steady. So maybe it is just a habit of how younger people are using the system compared to us old folks.
Yeah. I mean, you know, the thing is, like, I don't think I list comics as an interest on Facebook. I think I list superhero comics, and I think that I list specific things that I've liked a lot. So I also wonder if there's, you know, I mean, there are also sets of fans that we just don't know demographics of, because there's just too many damn books. You're not going to put in search terms for, like, everything. So I would be curious at some point to see which individual comics seem to have the most people listing them under their favorite books. I think we could make certain assumptions about that, but I'd still be curious to see.
Then I can come up with a way. There's a way I can figure that out. It's not going to be perfect, but it's at least give a good idea. But there I've got some issues of like, so like Swamp Thing and Sandman, I think have both, at least the original stuff. Well, I mean, it's obviously Sandman original stuff, but Swamp Thing are two series that have kind of gone beyond comic book fans.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
So I would imagine mostly
Watchmen.
Like,
people could, you know, I think a lot of people would list Watchmen, and they like who don't really read comics. Same with V for Vendetta. But yeah, those are definitely the pieces that I think would, you know, maybe the Invisibles, you know.
Yeah, and that's why I've always kind of stood away from using individual series in this demographic, because I'm just nervous on, you know, including them. You're going to get a lot of people who aren't. And at this point, like, it's 1.8 million people. That's a pretty good sample size to look at.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the I still go back and forth on manga. Like, I include manga because I think manga is a worthwhile thing to have. It's a type of comic. But even then, there's like this whole sub group of fans that I kind of shy away from, and you know,
it's a fandom.
Yeah, it's a separate thing. But I think overall, what's interesting is just using the word manga alone is enough that skews and changes the demographics that makes it worth it.
Mm-hmm.
Because that really accounts for why young women are the majority still.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, folks really need to realize that's really the majority of folks reading comics on Facebook, from what we can tell.
Yeah, I mean, the 17 and under is very manga-based, especially women. And that still holds true. That thing's been steady. Women have been the majority consistently, about 53-54% under 17. And then at 18 and up, it flips.
We gotta figure out how can we keep these young teenage lady folk reading comics, and, you know, even after they might lose their taste for manga.
Yeah, I mean, that's still, we've had that discussion. It's clearly something that's worthwhile going after. I mean, Boom Studios is doing this original graphic novel on Adventure Time. To me, that's like a great way to try to get people interested and reach out to an audience that might not necessarily be into single issues.
Yeah, definitely. And it's also interesting, I mean, I am beginning to think that, since I've been using Tumblr more, I really think that because of the way Tumblr hashtags work, like, normally I would say, okay, so let's say you're a huge Adventure Time fan, but you're not a comic book reader. How would you know that the Adventure Time comics existed? And the answer would be, if you're a hyperactive Adventure Time fan, you're probably talking about it on Tumblr, and you would see it from following the tags. So really, like, fandom itself has been used as a way to connect people to different parts of, like, geek culture, really, you know?
Yeah, I mean, and that's always been my argument of things, why things like Soap on Pipple were such a horrible idea, especially for the comic industry, because it potentially kills fandom. You know, Tumblr would get shut down in a week if that bill had passed. That legislation basically made restrictions for copyright intellectual property like even more draconian than they are now, to the point that putting up a video of you singing karaoke of a song would potentially be illegal with a fine and jail time. So the idea of fans doing art would just be crazy. We'd be absolutely nuts.
And, you know, this is during a time period where you have, you know, Boom Studios, for example, finding and discovering, you know, new artists, looking at what people are posting online. You know, that's like a way that people are getting out there, and they're really featuring work from those folks. And you're seeing a wider diversity of art styles in those books as a result as well. You know, so all those opportunities for that creativity would be really squelched if they had to worry about that.
Yeah, I mean, there's even now there's worries. Currently, Marvel and DC are suing a creator over the word superhero, which DC and Marvel have a joint.
What?
Yeah, they've got a joint trademark on it, I think. I'm trying to get the word right. Yeah, so this guy, Ray Felix, who has a series, I'm bringing up the article right now, of what the series is called, has the word superhero in his comic book. And Marvel and DC have decided to sue him to you have to do it to keep your trademark. So they're suing him.
So, like, Dynamite and Image can't have the word superhero?
Think about it. Do they use superhero for anything?
They don't really use superhero books, but do they? There's sort of a pulpy one that Dynamite is doing now, I guess. But.
Yeah, but I mean, like, Image has got lots of what I'd call type
Image
of
superhero. Has superheroes, yeah.
Yeah,
they don't use, like, Glory's a superhero.
Yeah, I think they call them, I think DC calls them metahumans at times. Image has some sort of term. Yeah, this one I came across on a site called Crisp Comics that has an interview with Ray Felix. It's great to go check out. And I've been trying to do the research and figuring out more about this and really looking into trademark law and getting all the details about it before writing up more of a, like, what the hell post. So his comic's called A World Without Superheroes.
That's crazy. I had no idea. That's just ridiculous.
Yeah, so they own the trademark to superhero with a space, no space, with an S. Like, it's, when it comes to comics, they've got it.
Wow. They should, like, sue me for the emails that I use, I guess, because I use that word in conversation a great deal.
Well, that's what I understand is, like, you've got all these, and this is why I'm reached out to a buddy who knows a bit more about trademark than I do. I mean, you've got tons of sites that have the word superheroes. Like, how are they not being sued unless it's not the fact that they are not a comic book, so therefore not competing?
That might be it. Yeah. That might be the difference.
Yeah.
That's sad. So, I don't know. I'm well and depressed. Let's talk about comics that we like.
Okay.
That will make me happy.
On this very depressing episode of Graphic Policy Radio.
That's what happens anytime we talk about industry stuff, pretty much. Did you read the Cake?
What's that?
Did you read the newest issue of Fiona and Cake, Fiona and Cake 2?
I have not. I uploaded it today on my iPad, so that comes out Wednesday.
Good. No spoilers or anybody, but I definitely think it was really wonderful, really fun. Folks should definitely pick it up. I think that it had some humor in it that would be really good for kids. This particular issue had some humor that would be really good for kids.
Does it start off with, like, the awesome story like the last one, which had like the...
The last issue began with a really beautifully told sort of a fable almost about the origin of volcanoes, and that was really lovely. But no, that was not repeated in those.
That's a shame, because that was my favorite thing about that first issue, and that it started off with this like beautiful fable. I mean, the art was amazing, the story was solid. I think that was the best part of the comics. I was kind of hoping, but no, I'm depressed now. No, I'm sad.
No, you'll like it. You'll like it. It's good. Everybody should read it. Pick it up. We both wanted to talk about FF. I think FF is the new Marvel Now initiative book. It's a sort of a spin-off of Future Foundation series that's sort of part of Fantastic Four's universe. It's Mike and Laura Alred doing the art and that fraction writing. And it has a very unique look for that reason. You know, there's really no comics artist whose work looks like his at all. He has such a unique style, and it's one that I like a lot. It's on its third issue, I guess.
Yes.
Did I tell you I finally got the Marvel AR app to work on those books?
You said you were having tons of problems, and then I still like it will start loading up for me, and I've got really jerky hands just because I have minor tremors, and then it would go away like the second that I shake.
The for some reason, the one that finally got working, I think I finally got the AR thing working on when I was reading Young Avengers, so I went back and I tried it on FF, and I couldn't get all of them to work, but I got a number of them to work, and they were definitely worth it. There were some interesting context. There also was some random, completely useless video of Matt Fraction talking, and he's very interesting. There just was no structure for it, so it was bad. If someone had been interviewing him or something, I think it would have been really good. But there was definitely some good bonus material in there, like flashbacks showing histories of things or whatever. They should have done a really fun animated sequence when they had that New Year's Eve sequence, but I couldn't get that one to work, so I have no idea what it actually did show. Issue three, where they had the New Year's Eve, where Darla Deering, who's really actually Katy Perry,
yes,
is wandering into the Times Square New Year's Eve ball drop.
I'll try the AR app and see if I can get it to work. Overall, like, I love the series. I think it's a lot of fun. It's interesting. To me, it's one where it's for the comic fans. It's not new reader friendly.
No, which is why it's hilarious that it's Marvel Now.
Yeah.
It's the least Marvel Now comic book of all time. But it's really good comic book. People should read it. Comic fans should read it.
It was interesting. I mean, you kind of had to do it, that it was one of the really early ones to launch, too. But you had to, because it needs to go, you know, side and side and hand-in-hand with Fantastic Four. So it being, like, one of the first ones to come out just seems so odd. It definitely, out of all the Marvel Now, it's one of the ones I like the most. Also because I think it's very unique. You don't get too many comics that are on the market that have that sort of pacing and style and quirky humor about them.
That's true. So how would you describe its pacing and style? I couldn't quite put my finger on what it was, but it is unique.
I'll say it's very Mike Alred, which doesn't
That's
explain
true.
It for anyone, but if you've read
no.
his stuff, you get it. And that's interesting because he's not the one writing. But it's got, like, the humor is really kind of, I would say, it's not really subtle, but there's just, like, quick hits that come out, like the Moloids who are obsessed with She-Hulk.
I have this voice for them in my mind. I have this voice where they all speak all things simultaneously and sort of sound like they're all saying the same thing but in a slightly different register and all very, very nasal. Like, I have their voices in my mind of exactly how they're supposed to sound.
To me, they sound like the Green Alien Toy Story. The toys.
They sound like the what?
The toys.
Green Alien and Toy Story. Yeah, that's not far off. Or if you watch Adventure Time like you should, I think they sound like that time that they have that giant frog with the tadpoles in its neck, and the tadpoles all speak at the same time, except for one of them is a little bit slower than the others, so it kind of messes up the whole unison thing.
Yeah, reference on that one.
Kind of like that. Definitely. You know, I've been really enjoying the comic. It's one of the new issue books that I'm reading that my fiance has randomly picked off to start reading off of the random pile of things I leave on tables. And he read it out of order, of course, and I found it interesting that he had no idea who White Wingfoot was. And, of course, no comic should ever assume that anyone knows who White Wingfoot is, really. But I guess the fact that he did not know who White Wingfoot was did not prevent him from enjoying it. He was like, is that Johnny Storm's brother, or what's going on? So I think so long as you're someone who's okay with walking into the middle of a comic story and not understanding and not knowing everything and just rolling with it, which is something that comic fans generally are, you know, I think it works really well.
Yeah, I mean, it's one that I think knowing the characters absolutely help. Appreciating Elrod's artwork is a huge thing. It's definitely for comic fans. It's not a book I would give to someone cold who's like not really sure or wants to check out comics for a first time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But it's good. Like it's definitely one of my favorite Marvel Now books. Where it's gonna go, I have no idea.
Yeah, it's true. It could really, I have no idea. And that's fine. I haven't been reading Fantastic Four books, like, ever, really. And I really haven't had any problems with it. I mean, I Googled a couple of things, but I didn't even need to. It is funny and charming and quirky and neat. And, yeah, it definitely makes you smile.
Yes. Yeah, it's one of those comics that I definitely have a smile on my face every time I read it.
But you know, here's one thing about issue 3. The exchange between Ant-Man and Darla Deering in the very end of the book was strangely physically intimate, considering their lack of having an existing relationship, really, don't you think?
There was that, and I also found him being small and hiding in plants creepy.
Yes, that is creepy. The book should have been made. It's one thing, I could totally see him doing that, but, they should address that that's creepy. That should be something which is addressed in some way.
Yeah, and she hasn't commented on it. That's the thing, is she needs to comment on it at some point.
Yeah.
It just feels like something you can't leave out there.
Yep.
Hey, you were spying on me while I was in a towel, and that's it. That's, you know, maybe we should have a conversation.
Yeah, about boundaries, you know.
So, yeah.
What else did you read this week?
I caught up on Captain Marvel.
Mm-hmm, me too.
So what did you think? Overall, we both love the series, right?
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah. Should we just say about the latest issue of the thing at the end?
Yeah, the art is completely different, very specific style. I don't know this artist. Have you seen this person's work before?
I can't think of it offhand. I don't think it's the best of the artists that have been on. It's still good,
no,
though. Overall, most of the stuff that's been on in Captain Marvel has been amazing artwork.
The artwork has overall been really, really good. This, I think, probably has been the weakest, but I respect that they're trying something new.
Yeah,
it's definitely really unique and very stylized.
Yeah, the art, it's familiar, and I can't think of where I saw it before. My only issue is it's just, compared to the stuff that's come before, it's, so far away from what that was.
Field.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, mm-hmm. I mean, most of the stuff, it was, Sabella and Rios were the last couple ones. Let's see here, Sabella. Christopher Sabella. Oh, no, Dexter Soy is the artist.
That picture's always been the artist for most of the books, I believe.
Yeah, and then Emma Rios was the other artist, it looks like. That stuff is all amazing. Yeah, the interesting, the writing, I think, and what we've talked about before was I wasn't the biggest fan of the time travel story arc. Like, I liked the writing, but not the story itself. Just as a whole, because I think time travel, to me, is getting boring and very rarely is entertaining now. But the writing was really good. Like, the character interactions, the characterization, all that was solid. But to me, like, the issue 9 was the best writing so far. It's a series I think the writing's getting better and better.
Yeah, this issue actually is not one of my favorites. I mean, I was good, but I would not put it as one of my favorite issues of the book, though I do like the cover a lot.
You can get the cover as a T-shirt.
I love that they're selling stuff with her logo on it. Like, that's what they needed to do. They need to have more characters with branded logos, more characters who are female, especially with branded logos. And I love that they're treating that little starburst as being her logo, and that's, like, fantastic, and it's going to work and succeed, and will sell things, and will make people ask, what is that shirt you're wearing, and people will talk about it. I really think it's a great move on their part to really logo-ize and brand her like that, you know, as a character. But anyway, I thought that this particular issue, like the whole story of, like, being an over-programmed superhero, meshing up with the whole story of being an over-programmed working woman, to me was sort of like a little bit been there, done that. There were some cute moments in it, you know, but it was okay. It was not my favorite issue, but you liked this one a lot, eh?
Yeah, so for me, and I'm willing to spoil the end of it for folks who haven't read it, so the first things I like is that she's given this new schedule by Tony in the beginning, and there's this, been this ongoing flirtation between the two of them, between her and Tony Stark, for quite a long time, which I really loved it. They buttered over. And you're looking at this thing, and the last one for all of it is take Tracy to Dr. Nair. And she's got this friend, Tracy, who is fighting cancer. I think it's cancer. Pretty sure it's cancer. She's been with her for, like, since the first issue has been, this has been part of the series. And I don't know if you thought of it. Like, for me, the whole time, I thought it was because of that is why she was going to the doctor.
Yeah.
Was to take Tracy to, for, like, a checkup.
A specialist or whatever. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. And then they flip it at the end, and it's, she's not there for Tracy. Tracy's there for her, and she gets bad news. I loved that flip at the end, especially the build-up throughout the comic, where you can really see that her being a hero is such a part of her that she can't have a normal life and a normal day. And it makes you wonder at the end of the issue, you know, what is she going to be like if she can't be a superhero?
Yes. I mean, she's someone who's so completely defined by that. All of her miniseries have really dealt with that. I really hope they don't sideline her for long. I'm really tired of female characters losing their powers with great regularity. But she is someone who's really defined herself by them, so.
Yeah, and
I guess
even,
be, you know.
And even then, it wasn't that, you know, she can't use her powers. It's she can't fly. So she can still, she's going to be fighting as Temptation. But the thing that I really like it is that she's a military person. And I think it plays well with these people who are sent off to war that, you know, we're seeing now is a massive issue with two incidents in the last couple of weeks of coming back and trying to live a normal life and not being able to adjust back. I'm guessing they're doing that a little bit, but I'm also crossing my fingers that they address that, because I think that could be a brilliant storyline that hopefully would add, you know, that deserves national attention, is bringing up basically, I'm not going to say that she's got like PTSD, but that idea of someone whose job is being a soldier and then that's taken away from them and they have to redefine themselves and figure out where they stand in the world. And I mean, I'm crossing my fingers that that's what they're going to do, but you know, who knows?
Yeah, I think I'll follow you there. Yeah, I think that's.
So I mean, that was kind of like, to me, that was the big thing, was like the bigger implication of what this means. or I'm reading too much into it and projecting.
No, I mean, I think that that's an interesting take on it. It's not what I got, but that's an interesting take on it.
So what did you get out of it? Because that was like the first thing that came to me. And usually when I kind of like, oh, this, and I don't see any other possibility.
I don't know. I think that this whole story is really about her trying to be everything for everybody. I like the way Suda Konik wrote Tony Stark, actually, quite a lot. And I like the character rapport between the two of them there. But, you know, she's such a character who's really defined herself by her accomplishments. And early in the series, and she was debating what kind of a flight record she could have that would actually count, that wouldn't take her superhero powers into account. She's sort of figuring out, like, what's her versus what's her powers, I guess. Yeah. Yeah, okay.
And you know, and Sue is a really good writer, so she might be taking a totally different direction. And I would be, like, I'd be happy if she did. I think that would be great if she did, but, like, potentially I think there's something really there, especially now with, I have a feeling this is going to be a huge issue in the next decade that people aren't prepared for and aren't ready to see, with wars ramping down, people coming home, you know, to see a comic basically seem kind of taking on that issue, I think would be fantastic.
Uh-huh. I agree. I do agree. And she could certainly do it. She likes to root her stuff in a lot of history and fact and research and all that. So,
and that's
a good point.
And that's the other thing, is like the first story arc was all about the women who wanted to be about the be part of the Apollo project, and they weren't allowed to because there were women. And what was like NASA's comment was, we don't want to put women in danger or something, you know, God forbid something happens. So the fact that she rooted that first arc in such a realistic actual history makes me hope and think that this is going to have something to do with that. But, yeah, it's like, to me, this is a great series that too few people are reading. Too few people are
reading. Yeah. Has there been any updates on the, quote, being canceled, unquote, thing?
Nope. It looks like there is a crossover at some points in the summer, I guess, or, you know, later in the year with Avengers, and at that point it's a wait and see.
I see. Well, she's writing Avengers now. Have you read her stuff on Avengers? I'd like to. I haven't picked it up yet.
Yeah, so she's writing Avengers Assemble. So Avengers Assemble, first there's a history in it. It kind of goes into why overall dislike Avengers Assemble. So Avengers Assemble came out right around the Avengers movie. It was a way... its purpose was one thing and one thing only, was to give people who went to see the movie something to read. It's not necessarily a bad thing, but to me...
No, it's actually a good thing. It's the kind of thing you should try to get them to do.
Yes, yes. But the thing is this was done so poorly. Like, I thought the art was bad. Things were just kind of, like, stuffed in the first arc, which had to deal with Thanos, like, mysteriously popping up and trying to get get the Infinity Gauntlet and take on the universe, and it just seemed like this story that should have been bigger, but just something didn't fit for me. And her take has been good. I've liked the characters and the characterization a lot more than the storyline in the first. It has to deal with this, I don't even know, a bad guy trying to put in a virus in water and getting people to mutate and bring about some evolution. Like, it's weird. So the arc, like, the story itself wasn't, I think, as solid as it could be, but I generally really like the characters, and she's got, I think, a good grasp of the interactions, and it's a less serious, more fun Avengers, which isn't a bad thing.
Yeah. Okay, I'll check it out. I mean, anything that has Spider-Woman in it, I keep saying that, and I do mean it.
And that was one of the things I really like, is that she's got Spider-Woman and Hulk, and basically Spider-Woman is kind of in charge of Hulk because, you know, she can use her pheromones and try to get him to calm down.
Wow. That's smart.
Exactly. It's a really, really good use of the characters. I think it's a lot, really funny. Like the arc, her arc, first arc, was better than what came before, which was written by Brian Michael Bendis. The second arc, it's better, and there's some really great moments. So we'll see what the next one is for me.
Cool. Thank you.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's so many books out there. I really wish I could get review copies of some of those.
Yeah, Marvel doesn't really.
Marvel.
Hmm.
Oh, for anybody else who has been following along with me, who is not you, Brett, because you don't like sword and sorcery stuff, with Demon Knights, I picked up the first issue of the new series. They jumped 30 years into the future and has a different creative team. It's okay. That's about all I can say. It's okay. They did make Shining Knight look ridiculously feminine in it, which is not, like, doesn't really work with the character. Like, the whole point of the character is that, you know, it's interesting, like, how they handled it in the comic. They have him sort of identify as being both male and female, but he really presents himself as male primarily. So having him drawn so female was kind of like, have you been reading this series till now? You've actually drawn it before. Why is everything so girly? But whatever. It was okay. I think Paul Cornell is a really excellent writer, and I'm missing him on this book already. Let me just say that. And I don't know what he's gone to do now. I think he's going to be doing something for Marvel, I believe.
Yeah, Cornell's hopping over to Marvel. I can't think offhand what he's going to be doing.
At least they're keeping the book around. I really do think that there's a place for it being a genre book that's not just a standard superhero book. But so far, Robert Venditti, writer, it was okay. I don't know. I'll buy the next one, and then I'll make a decision. How about that?
Yeah.
I had really enjoyed Paul Cornell's run such, you know, a great deal, really.
The speaking of DC switching writing teams, it's about time when all the new writing teams are starting to come out. So this week, come out Wednesday, is Green Arrow number 16. Which I officially can't review till Wednesday, but I guess I can review it on the radio show because it says no written reviews, I think.
That's a good point. You have the issue. I have not.
So I have DC is starting to send me some stuff, so thank you guys. And I'm making sure to do reviews of everything that comes out. So Jeff Lemire, who is an amazing writer, is taking over the series. And I remember you not being a huge fan. Like I think we all had the same issues with Green Arrow, where
it was
just
bad.
Yeah, it seemed like Iron Man.
Green Arrow series was bad. Like it was bad. It was corny. They were trying to turn him into Tony Stark. Oliver Queen is not Tony Stark. If you want to have a Tony Stark kind of a character, like do something with Mr. Terrific, I guess. You know, I don't know, but like that's not Oliver Queen. You know, and it was corny, and there were different beats of it that were kind of oddly sexist. I don't like him de-aged, to be honest, but I'll roll with it if you write him as an interesting way, but this was just bad.
So they actually sent me two copies. So ping me, and I will send you one of my two copies, and you can check it out yourself, and we can have a nice discussion. I really liked Lemire's writing.
Mm-hmm.
And the story seems interesting. Like, they seem... A lot of the issues that we had, he's quickly getting rid of and fixing.
Huh.
So that's, I think, a really, really good thing. And it'll be interesting to get your take to see what you think about the difference of it.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, Lemire's work has been really different, really creative, sort of dark, very Vertigo-esque, let's just be honest. And I've enjoyed it a lot. I'm not a huge fan, but I definitely have enjoyed it. And I read an interview with him where he was talking about his take on the character, and he basically said that he's someone who's never had any interest in Green Arrow, and he wanted to just do it, like, really hard-boiled, it sounded. Which, I don't know, like, maybe that's, like, Danny Grell Part 2.
Yeah, I mean, in the other would
Mark
be...
Grell, sorry.
Margo,
but I don't know. I guess that's not necessarily the direction I would see, but I'm willing to go for a ride and find out. wish he liked the character, though. I think that's usually useful.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, it should be very interesting as to where he takes it. It's enough that I think the issue 17 is good enough for me to go and give the first arc a try, basically. It's enough of a difference, and the writing, I think, was good enough that I want to check out issue 18. It's hooking me back into the series. And then the art's by Andrea Sorrentino, who did iVampire, and the art for iVampire is amazing. So good writing plus that art like makes it definitely for folks to check it out.
Cool. Yeah. That is quite a good team up, and I'm glad that they're not just abandoning that character.
Yeah. So other than that, the other, I think, the big one to come out this week that folks should be aware of is Fearless Defenders comes out from Marvel on Wednesday.
Ooh.
It is an all-female kick-ass team. So for all the talk of female-led comics, female creators, all that, though this isn't a female creator, but it's an all-female team. Go check it out and pick it up and support it and show people that stuff like this can actually do well and, you know, sell.
Yeah. I think there's been a lot of buzz around it. It's an interesting concept.
Yes.
And, I'm looking forward to picking it up. Absolutely.
Other than that, I think we're good for the week. If there's anything else you want to touch upon?
No, that's it. Looking forward to talking about those new books next week. And,
cool.
Well, thanks, everybody.
Yeah, and everyone, thanks for joining in and listening.
And if you have any feedback, you can just ping us on Twitter, you know, at Graphic Policy.
Yes, and then I IM'd you about it. Next week we have a guest. So that's going to be awesome because it's someone I think we all kind of want to talk to.
Mm-hmm.
We're getting Jeremy Whitley. Who is the writer of Princeless, which is an
Yay.
Awesome series. Everyone should read. It's got the second volume coming out in, I don't know if it's next week, but it's like this month it's coming out. So everyone go pre-order it and make sure the series does good because I've read the first two issues and they are awesome. So we get to talk about...
They really are. And buy them for all the children. They're like great for kids. Lots of fun.
Yep, absolutely. Easily one of my favorite comics of last year and quickly becoming one of my favorites of this year. So we're going to have an awesome guest. It was going to be fun. So I want people calling in and hitting us up with questions because he is a great guy and the series is amazing. So
definitely
awesome.
Turn in for that.
So cool. Until next week.
See you next week, everyone. Yeah.